Last week, Nepal officially abolished its 240-year-old monarchy. As a consequence, the ex-king is vacating his palace, and the country is trying to sort out a new kind of power-sharing arrangement among the various political parties, including the Maoists. With me now for today's Underreported is Thomas Laird, a longtime Nepal-based correspondent who's written for both Time and Newsweek. And also here is Nepali social and political activist Dr. Tara Narola, who is the senior vice president of the Nepalese American Council, an umbrella group for 28 Nepali American groups in North America. And I'm very pleased to welcome them both to the show.
Thank you.
If I had predicted 10 years ago that the monarchy would soon come to an end, would anyone have believed me?
No.
So it's all because of this incredible string of events that have occurred in recent years?
Well, I think, the monarchy died when King Birendra was murdered by his son. It had a slow afterlife in the Ganendra reign, but really, when that was the moment, I think even the people of Nepal really began to realize in 2001, they began to realize that it was dead, and it really wasn't going to come back. Ganendra's reign is sort of a coda to me in a strange way.
Well, first of all, how did the monarchy begin, Tara? 240 years ago, what was in place before that?
Well, basically, the ancient Nepal basically was divided into various small kingdoms, and the Shah dynasty was one of the kings in the small kingdom of Gorkha in the western part of Nepal. The great-great-great-grandfather of the former, newly, the former king.
The recently deposed king.
Recently deposed king, the Prithivinarayan Shah, was becoming very ambitious, and he started expanding his small kingdom by annexing smaller ones nearby his own kingdom in Gorkha. Ultimately, some 240 years ago, he managed to conquer the Kathmandu Valley, which then had three kingdoms, and those were the most powerful kingdoms at that time. And that's really when the larger Nepal's Shah dynasty began to rule the country.
And it was an absolute monarchy until just recently?
It was an absolute monarchy, but in between then, there was the king's power was taken over by the Ranas, who ruled for over 104 years. And the king during that time remained basically a figure eight. All the executive authorities were with the prime minister, and it was also a family rule.
Well, Thomas, these were the first elections in a decade. So, is it because of all of the turmoil that that things got disrupted?
Well, we had, as Tara was explaining, the kings of Nepal had their wings clipped in the 1950s, and then they managed to, the kings of Nepal took power from the Ranas, who actually are an extended part of their family, but at any rate, that's another story. They took power in the 50s, and then we were supposed to have democracy then, and then the kings really took over, and there were several attempts to clip their wings and several attempts at elections in the 60s and then in the 70s and then finally in the 90s. Birendra really had his wings clipped, and the power of the people was pretty firmly established in the revolution of 91, I think it was. So we had a series of revolutions, and then we had the 2006. So between 91 and 2006, we were supposed to have been in a period of democracy, but in fact we had this growing Maoist rebellion in the countryside beginning in 96. So we've had a great deal of chaos in the movement from monarchy towards democracy. And the recent elections that we've had now are supposed to be for a constitutional assembly, which is going to write this new constitution, as well as for a new parliament. So we've had a great deal of of disturbance running since the 2001 revolution, and then we had the 1991 revolution and the 2006 revolution, and in between we had the murder of the king. So there's been this tremendous, very slow movement with power moving back and forth between elected politicians and the king, the death of the king doing weird deals with the Maoist, Birendra doing weird deals with the Maoist in the 90s when they first came to power. The king, Birendra at one point, actually tried to use the Maoist to get rid of the Democrats. I mean, there's been a lot of backstabbing and back and forth here for decades. So these elections are the result of a very long, tumultuous process of internecine rivalry.
I want to get back to the Maoists in a little bit, but go ahead, Tara.
In fact, you mentioned about the Constitution Assembly, and in fact, that was promised by King Tribhuvan after the 1951 change.
Right.
That there would be this constitution assembly, which would, develop the new constitution for the Kingdom of Nepal at that time. But that was later on denied by the king.
Yeah.
And the political process, the democratic political process that began after the 1951 change, lasted only for a very short period of time.
And then the kings took complete power.
And then the King Mahendra, the father of this deposed king, basically took control of the total control of the power and instituted so-called the panchayat system,
right,
making the king absolute, and leaving no authority or power vested on the people of Nepal.
The only Hindu king monarchy in the world.
That was what was perceived to be.
Now, has King Yendendra accepted the news that his reign is over calmly?
He did. He did, and I think he also had no choice but to accept the people's verdict. And I think towards his later days as a king, I think he has been more graceful and has moved away from the position he was in a more peaceful way.
He's accepted reality.
I've had some recent conversations with people in Kathmandu who saw the king repeatedly during the last month, and they say that even 2 weeks ago that the king was telling everyone that would listen to him that, oh no, that he wasn't really going to be deposed, that he was going to figure this out, that the Americans were going to save him or the Indians were going to save him. He really never believed that he was going to be deposed. He, from what we're told from people who were talking with him, until the very last minute. And at that point, of course, he's had no choice except to accept the reality that he's been deposed.
Yeah.
When Chairman Mao kicked out China's last emperor, Puyi, he let Puyi stay on in a palace to prune trees and plant flowers because the emperor had been an avid gardener. Where is Yendendra going to live once he leaves? Does anybody know?
Yendendra he's being evicted from Narahiti Palace in the next few days if he hasn't already left. There's a small series of bungalows on a large mountain top just outside of Kathmandu, Nagarjuna, and it's a forest, it's a state park, and in that there's a series of royal bungalows, and that apparently is where he's going to spend most of his time, is in this large park in these small bungalows. He also has houses in Kathmandu which he can stay in as well. He's one of the wealthiest men in the country, so it's not like he doesn't have a house.
So he's retaining all the royal property?
No. He's not retaining all the royal property. Narahiti Palace is being taken from him, is being taken over by the state. Narahiti Palace dominates downtown new modern Kathmandu. It's like the size of 10 New York City blocks. It's a huge, dominant part of the city. And that's being taken away from him, apparently, to be turned into a museum, perhaps turned into a resident for the new president. There's debate. But he has other much smaller properties scattered all over the kingdom as well as around Kathmandu Valley.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned about his expectation that he would not be deposed by the Constitution Assembly or by the people of Nepal.
Yes.
I think that was part of his problem, because when he took the power in 2005, That's what I assume, that he was the most powerful person. Nobody yes. would touch him, and he would turn the you know the situation around and rule as an absolute monarch.
This was the problem with the kings of Nepal for the last 20 years. It's what led to the murder of Birendra. None of them could really ever understand what was happening around them, that they were not special people whom everyone would always defer to. Birendra, when he was murdered, when his son came in and shot him, his last words as he looked at him were, "What have you done?" I mean, he was just absolutely shocked that this son, who was drug-addled and had access to M16s, would turn them on him. But the fact was that the royal family had allowed him to continue to use drugs. And so they should, and it's very bizarre the way the kings of Nepal, they lived like in a bubble, and they're really out of touch with reality.
Well, that's you know, that's what we have learned. But I think most people, most Nepali people, do not believe that, you know, he was the, you know, mastermind of the royal, you know, palace massacre.
Yeah,
the
well,
crown
that's
piece. And that's
this is the way. This is the way all assassinations wind up, with people saying, "Well, there was a greater yeah. conspiracy." My guests are Dr. Tara Narola, who is senior vice president of the Nepalese Americas Council, and Thomas Laird, who has... How long have you lived in Nepal?
I lived in Nepal for 30 years.
Which, at a time often when foreigners were not always welcome in Nepal, written for both Time and Newsweek. But I know people who have visited who said, well, you know, it was all dependent on whether the king liked you or not.
No, the king's rule, even during the Panchayat period, I had press visas. There were a lot of foreigners living there. There were hundreds, thousands of foreigners living in Nepal throughout the 70s and 80s and 90s, and we were always made very welcome by the Nepalese, and we found a way to deal with His Majesty's government so that we could stay.
Yeah. We have to take a little break. When we come back, I want to talk about the Maoists. Stay with us. We're back with Underreported, talking about Nepal, post-monarchy Nepal, with Dr. Tara Narola and also journalist Thomas Laird. Let's talk about the Maoists. When did Nepal's Maoists become a force? Tara?
1996.
Maoists, well, Nepal always had a communist element even before 1990. But they were much more disorganized and fragmented, in the country. Basically, after the change in 1990, some of those Maoists actually took part in the mainstream political process, including the Maoist leaders who currently led this movement. But basically, after 1996, they decided to launch this so-called the People's War, to throw away the existing system and bring in their own type of government.
But what does Maoist mean in this context, since Mao's ideas changed any number of times over the years? Someone once told me that the Maoists in Nepal were closer to the Peruvian Shining Path group than anything that we might have seen in China. Do you see it that way?
Maoist meant different things to different people. If you were one of the 13,000 people whom they murdered or hacked to death, then you saw them as terrorist extortionists. But if you were amongst the women in Western Nepal, who, you know, when they had their menstrual periods in certain areas of Western Nepal in the 90s, you know, would have to go and live in a small little dog shed out behind the house, you know, when those little dog sheds were forbidden by the Maoists under pain of death, you know, then you were seen as a liberator of women. So the Maoists were many different things to many different people.
Well, you know, Maoists may have had connections to some Maoist elements outside Nepal, but primarily it is a homegrown phenomena. Mm-hmm. It is a they began as a class struggle, basically, you know, from the western part of the country, where there were all kinds of socio-political, economic weaknesses, and they were successful in capitalizing those existing, you know, weaknesses.
So they drew some support from the Dalits, the so-called untouchables.
They basically drew
weak and powerless people everywhere. You had people who were exploited under the existing system. Many of them looked towards the Maoists as someone who would liberate them from, you know, the excesses of the existing system.
On the other hand, they were an armed, violent guerrilla group who tended to kill people who got in their way.
Oh, it was. And I'm in the unfortunate position of having interviewed people who were maimed by them, having their arms and legs hacked off. And I must tell you that, you know, when people talk about a people's struggle or use these generalized words, I see the eyes of people who had their arms and legs hacked off, and I listen to them talking to me even to this day. So we can't underestimate the brutality of that was used on the people of Nepal.
And I think that played to a large extent, you know, why and how the Maoists won the recent election.
Well, let's talk about that. Here we have a group that believes in a revolutionary struggle, overthrow of the regime, suddenly participating in democratic elections. Can we trust them to continue to work as part of a democratic process?
No one trusts them. None of the other players trust them. They are constantly threatening to start going back and murdering people if they don't get what they want.
They continue to issue, you know, such threats even today, but I think there is a lot of expectation on the part of the general public in Nepal that since they have become you know, regardless of their all these threatening, you know, threats and all kinds of other unwarranted activities, there is a hope that they will accept this mainstream political process and this take this country towards a more, you know, desirable direction.
Well, they won 220 of 601 seats up for election, a little over a third, which does not really give them any control over anything, does it?
Well, the Maoists would argue that they have the mandate of the people, but in fact they don't.
Right. They didn't win 50% of the vote. They won like 30% of the total vote.
Yeah. They won, you know, less than 30% of the popular vote. Altogether,
right.
They have like about 37% of the membership in the Constitution Assembly. And that does not give them the, you know, the absolute, you know, people's mandate.
And of other political forces in Nepal, the other parties, in the wake of the recent election, the Maoists have said, you know, oh, well, we should have the presidency as well as the prime ministership of Nepal. And they were threatening to go back to war if the other parties didn't grant this. And in fact, the Maoists have stood down. So they've agreed, I mean, it's just in today's newspapers in Nepal that they're saying, oh, well, perhaps the presidency should go to some civilian. So in other words, perhaps a neutral party. And it does, I do have hope. I mean, even having, you know, even what we've been through and the death of so many people in the last year, decades with this Maoist war, there is hope now that there are factions within the Maoist movement who do seem to want to move towards a good, effective government that would try and relieve some of the problems that the many Nepalese face.
Well, the Maoists are on U.S. terrorist blacklists, and we've had a policy.
No longer, apparently.
Oh, we're now accepting them because they are part of this democratically elected government?
I talked with a source recently who says that the State Department has either just declared or will soon declare that they were never on a terrorist watch list.
Well, the State Department has been giving some conflicting information regarding whether the Maoists of Nepal are on their terrorist list or not. But what they said recently was that they were not really on the terrorist list, but they were on the terrorist organization list who were limited or prevented from traveling or using their, you know, properties.
So they couldn't come here and they couldn't trade with the West, but they weren't real terrorists.
Yeah. Well, what you have, though, is the U.S. government is doing a graceful backstep here as they face the fact that they're going to have to deal with the Maoists as part of the elected government of Nepal.
Well, about 20,000 former Maoist fighters are confined to UN-monitored camps as part of the peace deal that was reached in 2006. Do you, Tara, see them as a threat if these guys don't get their way?
Well, that's one of the challenges that the new government will have to face within the next few weeks. There are about 19,000+ Maoist guerrillas in United Nations camps. Maoists would like them to be integrated with the national army, but I don't think that's going to happen, and that should not happen. But what is the real? What may happen is that they may be, some of them may be used, for example, to integrate into the border security or the industrial security elements. But, you know, making them part of the national army doesn't seem realistic and practical because, you know, they will not meet many of the, you know, standards.
Right.
As well as, you know, it's a politically motivated, you know,
well, and
element.
The background of these fighters, I mean, these are people who, you know, some of them are participated in gross human rights violations.
Right.
So the idea that they would be integrated without training into the Nepalese army, the army is saying that they will, the army generals that one talks to says, no, that will never happen. But at the same time, if the Maoists actually control political power in Nepal, then if they command the generals to integrate some part of this Maoist army into what is now the Nepalese army, until recently it was called the Royal Nepalese Army, so if they demand that, it's going to be, the army would be put into a hard position if they didn't obey that order.
We have a minute left, and I just want to touch on one other subject. Many Tibetans live in exile in Nepal, and Human Rights Watch recently reported that in the past few months, Nepalese police have been arresting 2,500 Tibetans, for example, for protesting peacefully or simply because they appear to be Tibetan. So is there a growing anti-Tibetan sentiment in Nepal, Tara?
In the government.
New government that is just being installed?
The new government will be installed in the next few days or so.
So who's running the country right now?
Well, the coalition government that was that has been in place for the last a year or two, is still in place.
And they've been under tremendous pressure from China to arrest Tibetans, to suppress Tibetans, to prevent their free expression of Tibetan refugees in Nepal. Chinese government has put tremendous pressure onto the existing government, and everyone assumes that that pressure will not be reduced when you have a Maoist government in Nepal.
But the government position has long been that the Nepal will observe the One China policy. But on the part of the people you asked earlier, I think more and more Nepalese are more sympathetic to the Tibetan people. And that has been exhibited in Nepal as well as outside Nepal, even in New York area.
Well, Tibetans have been living in Nepal for over 50 years now in large numbers.
Yes. There's like 25,000 or so Tibetans living in Nepal, and they've been speaking with refugees that I know, many of them no longer feel as safe as they once were in Nepal. They really worry what tendencies the government could take in the coming decade.
Well, I mean, in Nepal, I mean, even the Nepalese don't feel safe sometimes. So that's situation.
Do you see positive aspects of this new government, or do you think that Nepal is still going to go through some serious problems over the next?
I really do think that, you know, whatever is happening the right way, and it's going to go to the right direction. And the Maoists are definitely going to lead the government, but it has to be the government of all parties, and that's given.
And my great thanks to both of you, Dr. Tara Narola, the Senior Vice President of the Nepalese Americas Council, and Thomas Laird, who is a journalist who's worked for both Time and Newsweek in Nepal. It's been a fascinating underreported. Thank you both.